You're tuned to Local Motion on KVNF. I'm Gavin Dahl. Coming up on this week's show, Colorado journalist Sandra Fish talks about following the money this campaign season. Plus, professor and journalist Corey Hutchins talks about our Capitol coverage reporter Scott Franz's investigation into the use of taxpayer money to attract out-of-state travel writers in the context of the ongoing discussion about a greater role for public funding of journalism at a time when many news outlets are struggling. Stay with us. Sandra Fish is a journalist with the Colorado Sun and other outlets who was just named by the Washington Post to the Fix's 2020 list of outstanding political reporters. Congrats on that recognition, and thanks for speaking with KVNF.
Thanks. It's great to be here, Gavin.
As a data reporter who follows money in politics, this is such a busy time of year for you. Most Coloradans are inundated right now by election information. For those wanting to know specifically who paid for advertisements on TV, online, or in our mailboxes, you and your colleagues at the Colorado Sun set up a campaign money tracker. Can you tell us about that, please?
Yes, we're tracking spending at the federal level that's reported to the Federal Elections Committee, outside spending in these contests, which there is a lot of in the U.S. Senate race and in the 3rd Congressional District race. It increases daily. We're also tracking TV ads, especially in that U.S. Senate race, which is pretty hotly contested. So we've got a lot of information on our outside money tracker. You can look at the TV ads in your area, in, you know, the Grand Junction area or Durango area, Colorado Springs and Denver. You can see that the ad spending is really, and the number of contracts right now is the hot and heavy time since about mid-September. The ads are all over out there. So, yeah.
And it seems like digital advertising must be the hardest to track. For folks who don't know, what regulators are in charge of keeping an eye on things? You got the Federal Elections Commission, Secretary of State's office. Who's watching what?
It's a really good question, Gavin, because nobody is. I mean, the Federal Election Commission hasn't had a quorum for over a year now, and they really have not regulated digital advertising or even all those text messages you're getting, and really neither has the Federal Communications Commission. And there's some places that are requiring that there's a disclosure on those, but it's really hard to get information in terms of who's spending what where. And the thing that your listeners should know is that these campaigns know via the platform who you are as an individual, and they are targeting you as an individual, but they're not really doing much in disclosure. And there's actually a group of researchers and journalists at New York University that's been trying to do more analysis of Facebook ads by using people like me have a tracker on Google Chrome, and it shares the information about the ads on Facebook that we're getting. And Facebook has threatened them with legal action this week to try to take this down. And, you know, it's a concern because, you know, Twitter actually stopped taking advertisement of a political nature. But Facebook, which also owns Instagram, that's a concern about how is that working, and do people realize how they're targeted?
And you've invited folks to take pictures of election ads they receive in the mail and email them to you. Has anything interesting come across your desk this year, or are you seeing anything different in the way that the mail side of campaigns is operating in the 2020 election?
One of the things we're seeing is a lot of mailers from the state parties, both Republicans and the Democrats, either promoting their own candidates for president or U.S. Senate or attacking the candidate from the other party. And I think it's because it's such a competitive race this year, especially the Colorado U.S. Senate race between Senator Cory Gardner and former Democratic Governor John Hickenlooper, that those parties are really taking a big interest in this. And nationally, there's so much money out there. These parties have money to spend on this.
Well, let's talk about the top spenders in Colorado. We have to start with the race for U.S. Senate between Democrat John Hickenlooper and Republican Cory Gardner. It isn't just those two campaigns or their parties spending money to influence voters in our state. Can you break this one down for us, please?
You know, people should know that the candidates, this is a record-setting U.S. Senate contest for Colorado. John Hickenlooper has raised an amazing amount of money, and so has Cory Gardner, but he's not close to Hickenlooper anymore. But you have all this outside money out there, and you have like Senate Majority PAC on the Democratic side has spent a lot of money up front. They stopped airing ads about a week ago, but they're still the top spender through Sunday with about $10.5 million. The National Republican Senatorial Committee and the Senate Leadership Fund, they're both spending out there on the Republican side. Giffords PAC, which advocates for tighter gun control laws, they've spent some money in that U.S. Senate contest. So those are sort of the top groups, are these outside groups that are really actually affiliated with one party leadership or another.
My guest is Colorado Sun reporter Sandra Fish. In one of your many recent articles, you outlined the three main categories of outside political groups spending money right now. Can you give us that set of categories for people to think about?
You know, there are political party committees, and that's more of like the National Republican Senatorial Campaign Committee or the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee. There are super PACs, and so Senate Leadership Fund is the Republican super PAC. Senate Majority PAC, or SMP, is the Democratic side. And those groups are a little bit linked. And then there are these dark money nonprofits, and both sides have groups like that. Sometimes they're pop-ups that all of a sudden you realize that there's this new group like Duty and Honor was spending money this summer on the U.S. Senate race, and it's connected with a nonprofit, Majority Forward, that's affiliated with the Senate Majority PAC on the Democratic side. You also have these nonprofits at the state level. One of the things about the nonprofits is they're not going to say vote for or vote against. They're just going to say good things or bad things about a candidate and let you make up your mind, I guess.
Well, let's talk about the third congressional district race between veteran Democrat Diane Mitchbush and newcomer Republican Lauren Boebert. For a long time, it looked like Boebert wasn't raising much money while she was hustling to in-person events all over the district, whereas Mitchbush was raising a huge haul and only really campaigning virtually. The two candidates continue to face, you know, what's considered a competitive race, according to polls. How have the numbers shaped up as of these most recent filings?
You know, Mitch Bush still has a lead in fundraising, but the outside money is just pouring in there. And that started about the middle of October. Through Sunday, you've had $6.5 million reported to the Federal Election Commission being spent in the third congressional district. And a lot of that, as people watching TV will know, is negative ads. There are about $3 million of ads opposing Boebert and $3.1 million opposing Mitch Bush. There, you know, Boebert is getting some support in mailers and in maybe some TV from outside groups, but you've got a ton of outside spending there, and I think before it's over, you'll see past records like from 2004 in the third CD broken in this contest.
What do you think, in all your years covering politics, what do you think about how effective it is to dump money into a race? For example, this has been a Republican seat now for several elections, and it's more competitive this time around. How much do you think that the spending moves the needle?
I think that most likely there are undecided voters out there in the third CD. There are not that many undecided voters in, say, the presidential campaign. That's why they're not advertising here. I think that people feel like by sending those mailers that they're sending or putting those ads on TV and radio, that they're trying to sway your listeners who haven't decided and haven't made up their minds yet. And I think that's probably a factor here, because people, Republicans and unaffiliated voters, used to voting for Representative Scott Tipton, who's held this seat for 10 years, five terms, and now he's no longer a factor. And they've got to decide, who are they going to vote for here?
With the numbers, the independent voters are the key to this election because, of course, there are more registered Republicans than Democrats in the CD3 and more unaffiliated than Republicans. So one poll that I just looked at in the Grand Junction Sentinel coverage showed that Mitch Bush has a commanding lead among unaffiliated voters. I think we know better than to trust the polls.
I think that it's going to come down, Gavin, to turnout and what happens on election day or leading up to it, because so many people are voting early by mail. But I think this is going to be one of the closest races in Colorado. And it's getting national attention because of Lauren Boebert's persona as the gun-toting rifle restaurateur. You're going to get a lot of attention.
When KVNF spoke to Lauren Boebert, at that time, she hadn't granted interviews to any other public broadcasters in the state of Colorado. I know CPR, KUNC, and others had tried. Is that unusual to have candidates for such an important contested election not have a single debate together and to avoid the press so effectively?
I think it's becoming less unusual than it used to be. It's really disappointing for the electorate to get a sense of who these candidates are. I'd note that Senator Cory Gardner also refused to talk with Colorado Public Radio, for instance. And I think that that's disappointing in terms of people getting to actually see and hear these candidates on their own answer questions. Gardner and Hickenlooper did have several debates, but we're seeing this a little bit more of candidates resisting doing things publicly. And part of it is often this resistance to being asked tough questions and having to expound on policy details and being, I guess they might think it's being put on the spot, but voters deserve to know specifics about what candidates expect to do when they're elected.
Well, before we go, at the state legislative level, Democrats are outspending Republicans. You wrote a story with Jesse Paul and John Frank at the Colorado Sun about the state ledge. What do KVNF listeners need to know?
They need to know that instead of looking at those mailers or the radio ads or the TV ads, that they need to go to their local media sources and look at what information those media sources are providing about the candidates at the state legislative level. And there are a ton of resources out there. One of them that I'll just pitch out there is Colab News, which is colabnews.co, has a really cool compilation of all the news stories from our 50 to 100 members. And we've compiled them in a voter guide, and you can actually look at that and narrow it down to a state legislative contest in your area. It's really important just to find out who these people are and what, you know, do their positions line up with yours?
Sandra Fish, Colorado Sun, you've offered voters a chance to ask for help, and you and other reporters track down answers. One of the questions that came up was about signature verification. Another was what to do if you make a mistake on your ballot. Any highlights you think we should end on today?
You know, one of the questions that I got twice yesterday, and someone at the top levels of government, we won't say who, but you know, mentioned it on Twitter today. And once you voted, once you've cast your ballot, you cannot take it back and change your mind, even if you've changed your mind. So if you think that you might change your mind, you might want to wait until election day. But you can't get your ballot back and change something on it once you've mailed it in. And really, what your listeners need to know, they've got to have that ballot in by 7 p.m. There are plenty of ways to find out where the nearest drop box or vote center is near you. It's too late, really, to use the mail. So you need to take it into a drop box or a vote center near you. Get it done.
And if you've changed your mind about something you filled in on the ballot, you can still go and vote in person instead. But like you said, there's no take backs once you've submitted a ballot.
Exactly.
Sandra Fish, thank you so much. How can people follow you on Twitter?
I am at Fishnet, Fishnette. Sort of a throwback. I'm kind of old. it's a joke, but I encourage you to follow me on Twitter, but you don't have to. It might be just like a little bit too weird. I don't know.
It's a lot, but keep up the great work and congrats on being named by the Washington Post as a political reporter to follow. Thanks so much for speaking to KVNF.
Great. Thanks so much. Talk to you later.
Hey, KVNF listeners, this is Bridget Law of the Tierro Band. Be sure to check us out on this week's Talkin' Music, airing Thursday at 6 p.m. and Saturday morning at 10:30 a.m. Stay tuned to KVNF Mountain Grown Community Radio.
My next guest is Corey Hutchins. He teaches journalism at Colorado College and writes about media for Columbia Journalism Review's United States Project. His weekly column on Colorado local news and media is a must-read for news nerds. Thanks for speaking with KVNF, Corey.
Yeah, always great to share the airwaves with you.
This past week, our Capitol coverage reporter, Scott Franz, who's based at KUNC in Greeley and distributes his stories to a dozen Rocky Mountain Community Radio Coalition stations, broke the investigative story of the Colorado Tourism Office paying for travel, accommodations, food, and other costs for visiting travel writers. In some cases, the stories were then published by news outlets without disclosing the financial arrangements to readers. You're a journalism professor and a reporter, Corey. Why was this story significant?
The story was significant for a couple of reasons. One, I don't think many folks, even who closely follow media like me, knew that Colorado's tourism office was paying journalists from out of state, in this case Texas, to come to Colorado on the state tourism office on the taxpayer dime and to leave and then write pretty positive stories about their experience in order to draw people from out of state to come to Colorado, especially during this pandemic. I saw a ton of Texas license plates across the roadways throughout the summer when I was out and about, and now I think I know why. It worked. The other reason is it creates an ethical question about the level of disclosure. Should the journalists who took the money from Colorado should they have told the readers that they did that to produce these pieces? Yes, of course they should have. In some cases, they did not. And after the story aired, they ended up doing that. They ended up disclosing. And in one case, this might be news to your listeners who have heard the story, Scott Franz went on social media and said that he learned that one of the stories that was in the works by one of these writers who took Colorado taxpayer money to produce a story, the owner of that newspaper is Gannett, and a Gannett spokesperson told Scott that they will not be running that story after his reporting. So it had some practical impact.
Yeah, after his story came out, the Austin American Statesman added disclosures to its stories, telling readers about the funding the journalists got from the Colorado Tourism Office. And then the owners of the Statesman, as you said, announced they will not be publishing one of the stories submitted recently by a freelancer who participated in this program. So we might see some impacts on transparency, but the state plans to continue this program without any obvious changes at the tourism office level. Isn't that right?
I'm not sure if that's what they told you, and it wouldn't surprise me. You know, I would consider this kind of reporting, it was investigative reporting, and one of the ways that Scott got this story was good old-fashioned digging. He told me that in his downtime, you know, when he's waiting for somebody to call him back or something, when he's not working on something, in his downtime, he scrolls through the state's online checkbook to see how our government is spending money. That's how he found these stories. I would consider it a kind of an expose. It told the public something that the public didn't know and wouldn't have known otherwise. The tourism agency probably isn't going to, you know, they realize that this works for them. And it's less of a problem, I think, for the state tourism office as it is for the publications and the journalists who were doing this and not disclosing it. But what's interesting to me on that front is the state of Colorado openly being willing to fund local journalism. How about that?
Well, let me ask you one more question about this story. When I first published to the KVNF website, Scott's reporting, I wrote that the office paid journalists for favorable coverage, but the tourism office actually reached out to KVNF and asked us to update that, saying they reimbursed the travel writers for expenses, and it wasn't necessarily for favorable coverage. Our news director updated the post on our site to reflect the difference. Is that a fair distinction?
I don't know. Would they have not reimbursed the reporter if the reporter came back with a negative story?
Yeah, Glenwood Springs, those hot springs are terrible. Don't go there. Thumbs down.
Right. It's kind of semantics there that they're concerned about. I think they don't like the insinuation that they're only paying for favorable coverage, or that there's some kind of quid pro quo here. Although they don't like the idea that it sounds like the state tourism office is saying, look, we'll only pay you if you come here and write positive stories. I think they realize that if they set them up with a rafting trip and soaking in hot springs and some nice meals and transportation, that they're going to have a great time out there in the backcountry of Colorado, that these campsites are going to, these hotels are staying, and then they're going to come back with a positive story. And then they have no problem paying that invoice.
Colorado practically sells itself. But, you know, some of these reporters told Scott Franz or have said elsewhere that they couldn't afford to do that kind of coverage without getting some of those bills reimbursed. So while Colorado is clearly a tourism destination, you can at least understand why the tourism office is approaching it this way. And like you said, it doesn't seem like this is so much a question about what they're going to do next as having this expose impact the outlets that are running the news. In your October 23rd newsletter, you put this conversation about spending taxpayer money on journalism to promote the state into a broader context about public sector support for local news overall. Can you recap some of these recent discussions about public support for media happening in Colorado? And let me just clarify, we're going beyond the conversation of members supporting KVNF through a donation or a subscriber to the Denver Post, beyond Corporation for Public Broadcasting kicking this tiny little amount of, you know, this tiny per capita amount into public broadcasters, into a much wider conversation.
Yeah, I'd love to talk about that because it's an aspect of journalism in Colorado that, you know, I think is not really talked about enough. And I don't think a lot of people realize that in Colorado, I think among our journalistic community here, we're having these conversations at a much broader extent than might be happening anywhere else except for maybe New Jersey, which just started a public media fund that we're going to state government is going to help fund local media there. So in Colorado, we've seen a few things happen fairly recently. Last spring, Longmont, Colorado made national news. Some community members there had floated the idea. They have they're a town where their local newspaper is getting smaller and smaller and doesn't even have an office there anymore. So members of the community wanted to do something about it. They floated the idea of perhaps creating a local library taxing district to help fund some sort of local news outlet. Didn't necessarily pan out, but it was an idea that got national attention in Columbia Journalism Review. I wrote about it. National Public Radio did a piece on it. And then later on, the Colorado Media Project, which is this organization that seeks to foster ideas to help sustain the local news industry in Colorado. They published a policy paper laying out, I think, five specific recommendations around the question of whether state and local government here in Colorado should play a role in stabilizing local media. And we've seen some people who have openly admitted that they never would have really been talking about it or thinking about this idea this way, you come out and say that they're thinking about it differently. We're talking about First Amendment attorney Steve Zansberg, who represents broadcasters and newspapers across Colorado. We're talking about people like Greg Moore, who is the longtime editor of the Denver Post. These folks openly say when they go on public panels to talk about this, yeah, we wouldn't have been talking about this 30 years ago because we weren't in such dire straits. Now it's time to think about things differently. PEN America is a national group that put its own policy paper out there saying that we need more public sector support in some form to help bolster the local news. And once that paper came out, they came to Colorado and held a public discussion at the library in Denver. And then we've seen at the federal level, our Democratic United States Senator Michael Bennett just a few weeks ago introduced federal legislation that will create a commission that could look at and explore the idea of expanding federal support for local news in some capacity. So that's happening here in Colorado, really more than elsewhere, even though it's kind of, you know, happening a little bit under the radar. It's kind of an insider media thing.
Well, and then Governor Jared Polis was asked for his take on this idea about state funding for local news back in the spring. How did that go?
Oh, yeah, you're right. So this was in April, you know, the pandemic in full swing. This was at a time when newspapers were laying people off or going online only and not printing because the economic impact of the coronavirus had devastated the local news business in Colorado and elsewhere. So a reporter asked the governor at a press conference, do you think the state could or should maybe step in and do anything? Does it have a role here? And the governor, the Democratic governor, Jared Polis, really threw cold water on it. And he said that, you know, we have a free and independent press. And he said that it's hard, quote, hard to reconcile with government assistance. He said the minute that Governor Polis or a President Trump is paying or propping you up, he said that causes an appearance of impropriety. And I will add some context to that. Well, his own tourism office is doing that. And his own economic development office has also indicated that it is willing to put state money behind the local news business in some capacity.
Well, there is an example of a pretty interesting example of the state funding news now. My guest is journalist and professor Corey Hutchins. Can you talk about the Durango-based company Local News Network and how much money they are expected to bring in this year from a grant via the governor's office?
So thanks for bringing this up, because I just rattled down a whole list of recent events that have taken place in Colorado that had something to do with public sector support of the local news. Well, here's another one. A business out of Durango called the Local News Network that produces these positive, good news, family-friendly video clips and then airs them on digital billboards around town, like at, the DMV or a bank lobby, even in a regional airport. That organization called the Local News Network applied for a $100,000 grant opportunity through a program of the governor's office, through the Economic Development and International Trade Office called OEDIT, and they got it. And it was the first time, the folks in state government told me, that it was the first time ever that the agency gave one of these advanced industry accelerator grants to a news publisher. So, you know, whether you think that is the kind of public sector support that folks like the Colorado Media Project or the National Free Press Organization are advocating for, and it's not, it is happening here. And, you know, it just goes to show, again, that Colorado seems to be a state that is, you know, having this, where people here are having these conversations and they're being taken seriously in some form or another.
As you have continued to follow in your newsletter, there could be pretty big implications for a change in this direction. But at this point, the closest we've got is a potential legislative direction from Senator Michael Bennet that would create a commission. I mean, it's not like we're ready for rubber to meet the road on this at a big policy level. At the same time, we're seeing this potential funding coming from the governor's office in this program you just mentioned, and obviously the tourism office, maybe not paying journalists, to be clear, but reimbursing travel writers for their costs and helping them have a fun time.
Yeah, and I'd say that's a bit of a mixed message from the state government, frankly.
Well, my guest is Corey Hutchins. He's a professor of journalism at Colorado College, writes about media for Columbia Journalism Review. His weekly column on Colorado local news and media is a must read for news nerds. You can sign up for his newsletter at tinyletter.com/Corey Hutchins. That's Corey with an EY. Thanks so much for speaking with KVNF, Corey.
Thanks for having me. And to all your listeners out there, support this public radio station so the state tourism office doesn't have to pay somebody from Texas to do it for you.
You just heard Corey Hutchins, Colorado College professor and writer for the Columbia Journalism Review based in Colorado Springs, and Sandra Fish, data reporter for the Colorado Sun. This is Local Motion. I'm Gavin Dahl. Thanks for listening.